about the pleasure of his rare tobacco. Or, because James himself never hesitates to pile up opposing figures of speech until he has sliced his thought to the refracted transparency he requires. Why not just switch metaphors and say that James sits mildly at his torture apparatus, turning the crank in meticulously calibrated movements as the reader lies helplessly strained upon the rack of his ever-expanding sentences, the exquisite pain of the lengthening description almost breaking the bones of attention. In short, as James often says after gassing on for a nice fat paragraph or two on the quality of a Venetian sunset or the knowing lift of a European eyebrow glimpsed across a table by an artless American ingenue, in short, he loves to carry on. Carrying on, I was discovering, is what it is to describe. A lot. At length. To trust description above plot. Past character development. And even theme. To understand that to describe is both humbler and more essential than to think of compositional imponderables, such as voice. Or to strain towards superstructures, like narrative arc. To trust that the act of description will find voice and out of its streaming attention will take hold of narration. By the time I was considering all of this, I had passed from being a reader and had become the more desperate literary type, a writer, trying to figure out how to do it. I was practicing without a license, never having taken a prose writing course. I had no idea how to sustain a narrative and didn't even understand at the time, 1980, that I was writing something called a memoir. Yet when I read Speak Memory and later read Nabokov's Command, caress the detail, the divine detail, I knew I had found the motto I could live by, the one that prevailed over show, don't tell. Perhaps only someone as thoroughly divested of his paradise as Nabokov had been of his boyhood Russia, his native language, and all his beloved associations and privileged expectations could enshrine the detail, the fragment, as the god of his literary religion, could trust the truths to be found in the DNA of detail, attentively rendered in ardent description. The dutiful observation that is the yeoman's work of description finally ascended, Nabokov demonstrated, to the transcendent reality of literature, to metaphor. Nabokov was asked in an interview if his characters ever took over. He replied icily that his characters were his galley slaves. Yet, when it was a matter of locating the godhead of literary endeavor, even a writer as imperious as Nabokov did not point to himself and his powers, but to the lowly detail. Caress the detail, the divine detail. Next to grand conceptions like plot, which is the legitimate government of most stories, or character, which is the crowned sovereign, the detail looks like a ragged peasant with a half-baked idea of revolution and a crazy, sure glint in its eye. But here resides divinity. Henry James emerges again with his faith in the rich principle of the note. In attending to the details, in the act of description, the more dynamic aspects of narrative have a chance to reveal themselves, not as action, or conflict, or any of the theoretical and technical terms we persist in thinking of as the sources of form. Rather, description gives the mind a place to be in relation with the reality of the world. It was a desire for the world's memoir, history, that paradoxically drew me to memoir, that seemingly personal form. I wanted to understand, or at least touch, the oppositions of the Cold War that had formed me. My Czech grandmother, a stray foreign figment from the old country, living with us in what I grew up calling the free world. Yet the great world, the place I wanted to find, could not possibly be in Minnesota. You had to get out on the road to find it. Let it rough you up. Another reason Montaigne appealed. A man who said he was most at home on his horse, riding free across unknown terrain, but who comes to us as the man sequestered in his tower, alone with words. The personal and the historical twisted together. So that old motto of my 60s generation youth, the personal is political, wasn't true after all. The personal isn't political, it's historical, a rangier yet more intimate embrace of oppositions, as the Cold War was a neat polar division for decades, the prevailing myth of most of my life. These oppositions meant that as a writer, I tended toward description, not to narrative, not to story. Maybe the root of the impulse to write is always lost, properly lost, in the non-literary earth of what we call real life. And craft, as we think of it, is just the jargon we give to that darker, earthier medium. It was my mother who was the storyteller in our house. I was her audience, her dear reader, in a way. I simply, sometimes bitterly, understood that nothing much was happening in our modest Midwestern lives, yet I clung to the drama with which she abused every vignette, every encounter at the grocery store. Nothing came of it all, but still, the details as she cast them before me were enthralling. Our nothing life sparkled with words, with description. And when I sought to make sense of the world that kept slipping away to the past, to loss and forgetfulness, when I protested inwardly at that disappearance, it was to description I instinctively turned. Coming from a first love of poetry, and therefore being a literalist, it didn't occur to me to copy other prose writers. If I wanted to learn to write descriptively, I needed, what else? Pictures. I took myself off to the Minneapolis Institute of Art and sat down in front of a Bonnard. I wrote the painting, described it. I went home and looked at a teacup on the table, wrote that too. Still life descriptions that ran on for several pages. I wrote and wrote, describing my way through art galleries and the inadvertent still lifes of my house and my memory, my grandmother's garden, her Sunday dinners. To my growing astonishment, these descriptive passages, sometimes running 2, 3 pages, even longer, had a way of shearing off into narrative after all. The teacup had been given to me by my mother, and once I thought of the fact that she had bought these cups made in Czechoslovakia as a bride just before the Second World War, I was writing about that war, about my mother and her later disappointments, which somehow were, and were not, part of this fragile cup. Description, which had seemed like background in novels, static and inert as a butterfly pinned to the page of my notebook, proved to be a dynamic engine that stoked voice and even more propelled the occasional narrative arc. Written from the personal voice of my own perception, description proved even to be the link with the world story, with history itself. Here was my mother's teacup, made in Czechoslovakia before the war, and here, therefore, was not only my mother's heartbreak, but Europe's. The detail was surely divine, offering up miracles of connections out of the faithful consideration of the fragments before me. No wonder Nabokov was a passionate butterfly hunter. More bright details pinned to a board. We sense this historical power at the heart of autobiographical writing in the testaments from the Holocaust, from the Gulag, from every marginal and abused life that has spoken its truth, which is often its horror. To preserve its demonic details, and in so doing has seen them become divine. the history of whole countries, of an entire era, and even lost populations, depends sometimes on a little girl faithfully keeping her diary. The great contract of literature consists in this. You tell me your story, and somehow I get my story. If we are looking for another reason to explain the strangely powerful grip of the first-person voice on contemporary writing, perhaps we need look no further than the power of Anne Frank's equation, that to write one's life enables the world to preserve, and more, to comprehend its history. But what of lives lived in the flyover? Lives that don't have that powerful, if terrible, historical resonance of radical suffering. Ordinary lives. Mine in middling Minnesota in the middle of the 20th century. Why bother to describe it? Because all details are divine, not just Nabokov's. In fact, the poorer the supposed value, the more the detail requires description to attest to its divinity. Which brings me to, if not a story, yet another vignette. Early in my teaching life, I went, foolishly, through a killer Minnesota snowstorm to get to the university because I had student conferences scheduled. You tried to dissuade me, but there was no stopping me. You can count on me. The university had closed by the time I arrived. The campus was empty, whipped by white shrouds of blizzard snow, the wind whistling down the mall. I sat in my office in the empty building, cursing my ruinous work ethic, wondering if the buses would keep running so I could get home. "Don't go," you'd said that morning. "I'll worry about you. Don't go." Surely you knew any attempt to control me, my word, not yours, only ratified any scheme or plan I had in mind. Then a rap on my office door. I opened it, and there, like an extra out of Dr. Zhivago, stood my 11 o'clock, a quiet sophomore, Tommy. He looked anxious. He was really glad I was there, he said, because he had a big problem with the assignment. I had asked the students to write short autobiographies. "I just can't write anything about my life," he said, head down, boots puddling on the floor. I waited for the disclosure. What would it be? Child abuse? Incest? What murder or mayhem could this boy not divulge? What had brought him trooping through the blizzard to get help with his life story? How would I get him to student counseling? Was student counseling even open? "What's the problem?" I asked, not wanting to know, but adopting what I hope was a neutral, therapeutic tone. "See," he said miserably, "I come from Fridley," naming one of the nowhere suburbs sprawling drearily beyond the freeway north of Minneapolis. I stared at him. I didn't for a moment comprehend that this was the dark disclosure, this the occasion of his misery. Being from Fridley meant, surely, that he had nothing to say. In effect, had no life. There it was again. Nothing had ever happened to him, and I was asking him to write about it. "I have good news for you, Tommy," I said. "The field's wide open. Nobody has told what it's like to grow up in Fridley yet. It's all yours." Wasn't this Montaigne's problem? And he, a seigneur, un grand homme, setting himself the assignment to sit in his cold tower and say what he saw, what he thought, professing in his to-the-reader note, the half-page that precedes the essay, that you would be unreasonable to spend your leisure on so frivolous and vain a subject. Even Montaigne felt compelled, though nothing had happened to him, to write books about it. Sit there and describe. And because the detail is divine, if you caress it into life, the world lost or ignored, the world ruined or devalued, comes to life. The little world you alone can bring into being, bit by broken bit, angles into the great world. Its voice, your style. Or call it what it is, your integrity. When you come upon the statue of Montaigne in Paris, you find him amid overgrown greenery in the Carré Paul Panlevé, across from the main approach to the Sorbonne on the Rue des Écoles. He's sequestered in the bushes, as if in bronze he preferred the margin he chose in life. The first thing you notice is his shoe. Even at night, the shoe emerges clearly, golden against the dusky bronze of his casually seated figure, cross-legged, bending forward as if to catch what you might be saying there on the sidewalk. People rub the shoe for luck, or maybe out of affection. A shoe rub is said to assure a good exam result across the street. It glows from all this human touch, an elegant 16th-century Mary Jane dancing slipper, blushing from generations of 20th-century fondling. The sculptor, Paul Landowski, is better known for his gigantic 1931 Flash Gordon statue of Christ the Redeemer overlooking Rio de Janeiro, an Art Deco Jesus. Montaigne's statue was done 2 years later, in 1933, perhaps to honor the 400th anniversary of his birth in 1533. Something of the dandy about that shoe. Then the face, surprisingly intent, looking back at you. The face of a man who appreciates the finer things, wryly amused by this weakness for pleasure, not haunted by his appetites. Landowski has given Montaigne a 20th century face, nonchalant, warm, easy, a winning American mid-century face. This bronze Montaigne, like the one I've been reading these recent years, sees it all and accepts it all in advance. The all of human perversity and contradiction and marvel, played out on the field of avidity and longing. With abundant relish and genial curiosity, he would take easily to the shape-shifting of our times. Gay? Straight? Transgender? Intersex? He was pondering versions of these possibilities in an early essay from 1572, of the power of the imagination, piling up examples. A man whom the Bishop of Soissons had named Germain at confirmation, but whom all the inhabitants of the place had seen and known as a girl named Marie until the age of 22. He was now heavily bearded. Without dismay, he regarded this richness of possibility as evidence of the natural state of human affairs, an aspect of the legitimate sovereignty of the imagination, and thus, imagination the best judge of reality. It is not so great a marvel that this sort of accident is frequently met with, his laconic response to the array of identities. This is, after all, the man who said of his work that he didn't portray being, I portray passing. Ripeness is not all. Change is. Flux as the only genuine constant. Life, not as a circle, but a spinning spiral. The imagination running the show. There it is again at the heart of life. The imagination. That old occasion of sin under the beechnut tree. Leaves swishing above, body flat on planet Earth, the mind aloft, refusing to behave, even if I was, and I was, a good girl. And also now, all these years later, as I was told in Llangollen, a nice lady. The imagination as the crucible of freedom, We are made to contend with life along that ragged seam of being. Consciousness, Montaigne is saying, will accommodate just about anything. It is our rightful business to think, to muse, to wonder, to describe, using this image-beset faculty of mind for the job, one vignette after another. Montaigne was perfectly positioned to display the power of the imagination, perched at the pivot of medieval magic, angling toward modern rationalism. "To me, magicians are poor authorities," he says. "Nevertheless," and on he goes to list charms and weirdnesses he's heard of or witnessed himself that attest to the sovereignty of the imagination, flying monks, various fabulous testimonies, and a homely vignette of his own, his observation as exact as a lab researcher taking notes. "Recently at my house, a cat was seen watching a bird on a treetop, and after they had locked gazes for some time, the bird let itself fall as if dead between the cat's paws, either intoxicated by its own imagination or drawn by some attracting power of the cat." Montaigne is a great believer in thinking makes it so, and tells of a woman who was informed, as a prank, that she was eating a pie made of cat meat. She believed, or too completely imagined, what she was told, seeing in horrified detail the kitty she had just scarfed down. She fell into a violent stomach disorder and fever. The result of this overactive imagination? It was impossible to save her. There's the imagination for you. It was raining the night I first saw the Montaigne statue, and though it may seem I was seeking another of my literary shrines, in fact yes, you were on this trip too. We just happened upon it. We were running late, trying to locate a fish restaurant recommended by a friend who knows Paris. Dripping in his leafy bower by the university, gleaming from the wet, or maybe because I'd been reading him, living with his sinuous sentences in my head and had no idea such a statue existed, this bronze Montaigne had something of the apparition about him. Like Whitman, another eccentric of the first-person voice, he was just loafing by the side of the road. Out with the iPhone. Snap, snap. Got the shoe. Couldn't quite get the face. You were patient, standing there in the dripping cold, holding the black umbrella over me as I got the shoe, tried for the face. Only now I see you were glad to pause in the rain, glad not to keep up the pace. It was the beginning of slowing down, the beginning of your bum ticker deciding things, the beat slowing, slower, stopped, finally. But we didn't think that then, or I didn't. I thought you were being patient, something I could never be accused of, rushing, always rushing. "Take as long as you need," you said, "the beginning of slowness, or the beginning of patience. These things creep up on a life, in the dark, in the rain." In our case, with the genial bronze man smiling indulgently from the hedgerow. For Montaigne, it starts with death, his meddling with writing. Death occasions his decision to retire from his life as a courtier, a public life, to his cold tower, in order to see how he sees things, which is to say how he describes things. In swift remove, he lost his admired father, Pierre, 5 infant daughters, and a brother, absurdly, from a tennis ball to the head. 16th century tennis balls were made of wood, which does take the bounce out of the game. All of these relations were gone before or soon after he retired to his chateau in Périgord. He was 38. But the searing, permanent heartbreak was the early death of his beloved friend, Étienne de la Boétie, the great love of his life. He would have understood the ladies. His great love was a friendship, not a liaison, though our age, of course, suggests he was really gay. Probably, potentially, maybe, surely. Maybe he was. Maybe he would have been. But he saw the relationship and mourned it as the perfect friendship. And he saw friendship as the perfect relation. Marriage he treats with a kind of measured contempt, a wearisome necessity. Marriage can be compared to a cage. Birds outside it despair to enter, and birds within to escape. His own wife, with whom he had 6 daughters, an afterthought. And his mother, barely mentioned, though his father was adored. It was the loss of the perfect friend, he mourned, a loss that never would, never could be comforted. Such a friend could never be replaced, except perhaps by continuing the magical intercourse of shared thought by writing what amounted to letters, the essay. It was a melancholy humor and consequently a humor very hostile to my natural disposition, produced by the gloom of solitude into which I had cast myself some years ago, that first put into my head this daydream of meddling with writing. He says. Donald M. Frame, Montaigne's great biographer and translator, believes that if La Boétie had lived, no essays. Even Montaigne believed that if he had a strong friend to address, he would have been more successful as a letter writer. In effect, we're reading in the essay something between a diary and a collection of letters, in any case, personal documents. At the Paris Fish Restaurant, which we finally located, you were making a pitch for a different trip, to Sweden, for Linnaeus, that 18th century figure you kept encouraging me to pursue, the Swedish botanist whose system of binomial nomenclature, like the ladies, he was a system person, earned him the title Father of Modern Taxonomy. Surely a botanist was another daydreamer, a leisure man? A lot of peacefulness in botany. Think about it. I did. I liked this idea, partly because my father, a romantic florist who rolled off the Latin binomial names of plants in the greenhouse, always tried to get the rest of us to do the same. Daisy? Why not have the pleasure of saying Bellis perennis? A rose is a rose is a rose, of course. But the daffodil? Let it luxuriate in its full Linnaean title, Narcissus sylvestris. Rousseau, who had no time for Montaigne, asked a friend to send a message to Linnaeus on his behalf. Tell him I know no greater man on earth. Goethe piled on about his brilliance as well. With the exception of Shakespeare and Spinoza, he wrote breathlessly, I know no one among the no longer living who has influenced me more strongly. It was an opinion Linnaeus shared. No one, he wrote of himself, has been a greater botanicus or zoologist. No one has written more books, more correctly, more methodically, from his own experience. No one has more completely changed a whole science and initiated a new epoch. No one has become more of a household name throughout the world. He also modeled for the new epoch the essential modern quality, a gift for public relations based on self-regard. Still, the idealization of the new epoch was perhaps the key to the praise others lavished on him. The idea of finding a system, or not finding one, but constructing one for all of creation, was at the beating heart of the Enlightenment's dawning romance with science. How thrilling not to be lost forever in wonder, that ancient veil cast over life's mysteries. How amazing to discern a relation for it all, the connective tissue of creation. Linnaeus's Systema Naturae and Speciae's Plantarum formed a classification system, housekeeping for observed forms, zoological and botanical. But the system was not a key to internal structures and didn't anticipate evolution. Linnaeus saw creation as static. His goal was to describe what God had created without the notion that this creation was an ongoing project. No portraying passing for him. Did not stop his contemporaries from seeing his system as the work of genius. Biology has augmented and complicated the understanding of living organisms since his time, but Linnaeus's naming system is still used today, slotting life in hierarchical order: domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. The last two categories, genus and species, giving us the name and family relation of a particular plant. Perhaps the great appeal, almost a sigh of relief from admirers like Goethe and Rousseau, came from the sense that Linnaeus was promoting science as a humane system, creating a universal language, and therefore making peace between science and philosophy, what we call the humanities. His taxonomy was not held tight-fisted by gatekeeper specialists. The sexual identification system Linnaeus devised, based on number, size, and method of insertion of plant stamens and the female pistils, was open to anyone to use. Nor was it regional and limited. It was wondrously global in its reach. But the more I read about Linnaeus himself, the grandiosity, the marshaling of his ranks of students, whom he preferred to call apostles, in quasi-military uniforms, marching through Uppsala like a private militia, his mock Laplander costumes, the more I was drawn back to my modest monk and his pea plants in the Brno monastery garden. The garden was still my idea of Eden, the demilitarized zone of science where poetry, singing the Psalms, punctuated the lab work. I'm sorry, though you thought I should go there, and I said I would. I never went, after all, to Sweden. One of the things you never knew. After all the shilly-shallying, the note-taking and reading, going here, going there, Montaigne plugged into my ear from the iPhone, before I was ready or deserved to visit his world, as I'd come to think of his tower, here it finally is, late April, and I'm driving with my English friend Annette in the passenger seat of the little rental car out of Charles de Gaulle, off at last to the chateau near Bordeaux. If two people are still friends after negotiating the périphérique out of Paris during rush hour, one hunched over the wheel, the other bent to the autoroute map to get the direction. Left! Left! No, straight! This is a friendship for the ages. And no, we did not have Google Maps or cell phone apps to lead the way. We were cast upon the torrential waves of the superhighway until finally we were funneled out of the traffic tsunami, from one slightly saner road to another, and still another one yet more untraveled, until at last, already at dusk, we were on something marked with the mild brown signs indicating a scenic or cultural heritage road, narrow, tree-lined, becalmed. More than that, French. French, as Sister Perrin Marie had taught us, the France of order and sane plaisir, three-hour lunches, the promise of wine and lavender and figs, even if all that was a season in the future. It was blossom time, the landscape radiating youthful relish for the day, the meal, the moment. The road was not called the Route de Montagne, but was named for the greater personage of Périgord, the goose. The Route de Foie Gras. In some English language guides, the Route of the Fatty Liver, suggesting a disgruntled vegetarian in charge of translation. We didn't make a beeline for Montaigne's chateau. We seemed to be following his own meandering habits, content to get there a day later. Make that 2 or 3 days later. Whatever. Or maybe we were fattening up on the spring glory of the region, like geese at their feed hoses, stopping our first night at an old chateau. Do I even know what exactly makes a building a chateau? It may have been just a rangy country house, not exactly tatty, but pleasantly worn around the edges. Nothing grand, but pleasantly ample. The place, we discovered, was often rented by local families for weddings. But this was a weekday, and we had it to ourselves. The owners, or perhaps the employees, almost off duty, cheerful and unrushed, hung around our table to talk. Annette really speaking French to them. I, the patois I carried forward from high school. We sat in the shadowy dining room overlooking a field where horses occasionally passed by, heads down as if taken up with private considerations. A sideboard with dull silver plate, candelabras, a large chipped faience bowl mounded with green grapes, a few scissored leaves attached. Wine, of course, faded gold in cloudy goblets. Not Vlasta's severe Moser cut glass, her mother's fine crystal, that had made its way through wars and the breakup of empire to sit in unlikely splendor on her Panelac table. These were homey, Frank Van Ordinaire glasses, the rims rounded, the stem stout. Country glasses. We were offered more wine. Annette, using the delectable French idiom, nodded, smiled. Une larme, s'il vous plaît. Just a teardrop, please. But of course, the glasses were filled to the top, the gold winking, night now covering the view. A slightly mad quality attended the place, where the old was still alive, still dying right in front of you, the banged-up candlesticks dating from who knows when, cheek by jowl with a plastic-sheeted portrait of Marilyn Monroe fixed to a back wall, right against the good bones of the stone. Candles, the rest of the wine, chicken unctuous in a bronzed sauce, pale shallots pillowed under the soft lacquer of the sauce, and sweet. Then some kind of nut liqueur in tiny shot glasses, sipping, sighing. The first night. We stayed at other inns, some quite proud of themselves, one outfitted with an infinity pool, another with a stiffly tended garden, koi moving with exquisite idleness in the central lily pond. I still get email offers from one place promising un bon séjour, urging Christmas, New Year's, perhaps my birthday. But that first night in the drafty old country house we found almost by mistake, and we, the only guests, the shadowy rooms waiting like backstage sets to be brought forward for next weekend's wedding party, the off-duty horses unbridled till later in the week, when they would be latched to the rickety bridal carriage. This was the sweetest place we stayed, the one that hasn't faded away. Strange that the name is nowhere to be found in my notebook. As if it never really existed, concocted sheerly of desire and the frenzied exhaustion of getting off the periphérique and onto the roadway dedicated to the silken livers of snowy geese. They are happy! Happy, madame, to be fed. Do not call it forest. They line up for the hose. They cannot wait. This rather frazzled place is the one lodged in memory. Though I have iPhone photos of the others, their color-coordinated lavender bedchambers, tender walls painted a rainy green, rouged-up interiors, fay settees with toile upholstery, and giant beribboned bundles of dried lavender in purple glass vases. Design reminders that we were settled into a gentrified France profonde. But the pictures that persist are not on the iPhone, but in the mind. That first night, the benign scruffiness of that nameless farmstead. This preference was not simply occasioned by the hominess of the whole enterprise. Or if it was just that, I took the hominess as an assurance that we weren't being invited to congratulate ourselves on having located the upscale nostalgia of the restored and improved French country houses in the Luberon, farther south, of Peter Mayles and those who followed his well-polished dream in the 1990s real estate fever for Le Sud, a possessive love that changed forever the ancient habits of farm and pasture to gastro-tourism. Or saved it from the decay it had already entered? Depends on your source. As someone said, a developer is someone who wants to ruin a beloved landscape with a house. A preservationist is someone who already has a house there. We could feel that first night, a different kind of vanity, that we had dropped off the pleasure trail of the Route du Foie Gras and tumbled into the France beloved of the writers who had discovered it before it was massively discovered and deeply touristed, Ford Madox Ford and Sybil Bedford, and later, after the war, the American poets. W.S. Merwin, who owned a little ruined patch of Provence as a young man who fell in love with the troubadour poets. And my first favorite, James Wright, with his poems about Minnesota, and then the ones about Nîmes, the world of snowfields, my world, leading him to the improbable fields of lavender and thyme. And here I was in it too, finally and for real. Well, not for real, but for a time, maybe an ardent note-taker, but still, I was a tourist. I'd always imagined living in France. You teased me. No matter where we went, I was always checking real estate listings online, especially places in France. We could sell the house. We could move to France. Yes, I suppose, you would say, not rising to the bait. Sometimes when I got too annoying, you allowed yourself to say, I thought you liked it here. I do, I'd say. I do, but... Once there was Google and Zillow, I was a lost cause. Find any chateaus for us, you'd ask, passing by my desk, the computer leaping from the Bouches du Rhône to Brittany, farmhouse to sea cottage. My expat life became a pure act of the imagination. I wasn't thinking of Montaigne that first night on the way to his tower so much as of the life not lived. Maybe only a Midwesterner can sustain this geographic passion over a lifetime, the desire to be elsewhere, even in the midst of a happy life, our life. Tommy came to mind, the undergrad tromping through a Minnesota blizzard to confess forlornly that he had no life. He came from Fridley. That deepest Midwestern sense of place, the yearning to escape. The homeboy, Scott Fitzgerald, got himself gone, and glad of it. Another of my literary heroes, Mavis Gallant. She abandoned the North American middle for the lonely loveliness of France. Think of her great expat stories. But she belonged to an earlier generation. The sorry hotels of her strays were out of a France W.S. Merwin and James Wright might have glimpsed. But that aura was more foreign to me even than the Provençal landscape. In my reading, I sought a contemporary, someone who lived what I thought of as my other life, the one not lived, but so lavishly imagined and desired that it felt not like another life, but a version of my own. You feel, I did, deep contentment when you find such a life expressed by a writer who has lived it, as if in reading that life you sort of live it too. Even better, if the writer is someone you have discovered, the way people think they discover a landscape. This long-beloved landscape of France, for example. Just before I came to France to visit Montaigne's tower, I found in a bookstore, by accident, just such a figure. Gustave Sobin, born in 1935, so not my generation, but nearer than Mavis Gallant, nearer than W.S. Merwin or James Wright. I didn't know anyone who had read him. Good. My find. You, though, with your deep reach in American poetry, especially the experimental edges, friend of Ginsberg, promoter of Tom Gunn and Robert Creeley, encourager of Ed Sanders and the Fugs, you maybe had heard of Sobin. Possible. But you weren't talking, not anymore. Just me. Still muttering around the house to you, the dog looking at me steadfastly, worried. In spite of the intriguing continental name, Gustave Sobin, I found, was an American. After graduation from Brown, he was born in Boston, had a private school education, he made the leap to France, looking for poetry, and found it in his hero, eventually his mentor and friend, René Char. Sobin arrived in Paris in 1962. He lived most of the rest of his life in the Vaucluse department of Provence, almost Montaigne country, given that Montaigne went to school in Toulouse. Sobin met and married a British painter there, and they had two children. He was already dead, from pancreatic cancer in 2005, just 69 years old, when I discovered his books. According to an online tourist site for the region, his town, Cavaillon, has a market every Monday morning along its main thoroughfare. It is probably the least charming market of the Luberon, the text reads, somewhere that locals shop for cut-price clothing, bargain underwear multipacks, fabrics, leather goods, bedding, bags, household products, etc. As such, it is real. But reality probably isn't why you come to the Luberon. By the time I read this line, I felt I knew Sobin well enough to see him smile, shake his head. Some gesture to note this irony. The whatever, quotation marks around the word real. The frank sniff that a person doesn't travel to the Luberon looking for reality. Not now, perhaps. Though clearly he had. Sobin would have relished, I felt certain, that his market town had not succumbed to the creamy charm of artisanal proud Luberon with its stratospheric land prices for ruined cottages, one of which he had bought decades earlier as a young man looking for poetry. It wasn't his poetry that let me feel I knew him and could conjure his dry humor. Not even his fiction did that. Though I admired his slim novel, The Fly Truffler, about a widower whose Provençal tradition of hunting truffles allows him to encounter his dead wife in dreamlike meetings while searching in the damp underworld of the woods. There was too much magical realism for me, I suppose. Or maybe I was becoming allergic to widow books, determined never to write one. Though, look at me. It was Sobin's essays that grabbed me, his final work, appropriately for someone who had written a novel making a metaphor of finding the reclusive truffle hidden underground, and for a man who watched as the ancient quiet of the region he had chosen for its reclusiveness flipped into a real estate boom. His essays are about what he calls vestiges, the bare traces of prehistoric and medieval life in his adopted landscape. The world before change overwhelmed the furthest, deepest reach of history. He often found these vestiges as he walked the isolated territory near his home in the Vaucluse, and in his reading of obscure accounts of the region, memoirs, old civic documents, scientific papers. His essays are about these encounters with the deep past, the lost, invisible past, beyond memory and reckoning. He delicately stitches together tatters of the historical fabric rent by time. Breathtaking essays, reconstructing, it's tempting to say resurrecting, Provençal fossils, while never letting go the urgency of inquiry into the buried past we live atop. Obscure, usually encrusted, more often than not illegible, he says. These artifacts establish points from which we might situate our own existence today. Who cares about fossils? Not me. Even Sobin admits laconically that, for myself, the past per se holds little interest, and the present offers only the profound malaise of a culture increasingly devoid of the protocols of self-reflection. Another leisure man. For isn't it leisure alone that safeguards reflection? That cloistered nun years ago. Maybe she started all this. You and your nuns. I had asked her what her way of life was based upon. Love of God? The search for meaning? What was the foundation of contemplative life? Oh, she said without a pause, leisure. It's based on leisure. I put her in a book years ago, and here she is again. Bears repeating. She didn't say her life was about leisure, but based on it. Sobin's fossils, his shards and chips, don't expose the recondite obsession of a pedant. They form a lens of penetrating inquiry. His essays bring forward what archaeologists uncover with their tiny brushes, their manicure-set tools, and their infinite patience. But he does it in language, a world lost but still there, which is to say, here. It's important to the power of these prose pieces that Sobin is not an expert, that he's determined to understand, sheerly by pondering the evidence, what is hidden in the charnel house we live upon. That's why they're essays, and not studies. Why they pulse with urgency, and are humble and passionate, even as he is grateful, almost reverent about the scholars and paleontologists he counts on for expertise. I read all these late books, Luminous Debris, Ladder of Shadows, and brought along on the trip the bare sheaf of pages that comprises the final one, Aura, Last Essays. He had more essays projected, and in the thin trail of sentences at the end of Aura, his widow, his editor, provides an appendix of these unfinished, perhaps even unstarted essays. An account of a trip he planned to undertake following the exact pathways of Petrarch's 1336 ascent of nearby Mont Ventoux. An essay on the scarcity of light in medieval homes and the sacredness invested in candles and oil lamps. An essay on leprosy. Another on the extrasensory function of church bells. On and on his inquisitiveness goes in this list of unwritten essays. Pieces about matter, the color that vanished. About Van Gogh's Arles bedroom. Another on Charles Pumier and the Adamic naming of flora. Another person seeing the botanist as organizing angel. Finally, the death of Provençal. The last in his billowing list of anticipated essays. A long essay, his final notation says, recounting the last liminal traces of a language and inseparably a millennial culture. On the very point of vanishing altogether. Vanishing altogether. the very thing he was in the process of doing as he listed these never-to-be-written essays. He had found his subject and his form, the traces of lived life, vestiges, a stone, a fossilized bone, a statue's torso. In these prose pieces, he moves beyond his earlier literary forms, poems, novels, to the mind itself. Ruminative pieces recounting his fascinated study of loss and remembrance, as evidenced in the bones and shards of Provence. What he calls vestiges are the physical evidence of what I've been calling, in narrative terms, vignettes. Both prove the enduring presence of life in the teeth of death, in the lived aftermath of death's reality, the fossil, the bone chip, the memory of the hand grasping mine. They are still here somehow, not quite lost to the touch. And so Sobin, who came to deep France to be a poet, finally becomes an essayist, heir to Montaigne. He retired early to his cottage, if not to a chateau, seeking the reflective mind, its presence in life and history, and in himself. Looking not for a self, that thing modernity keeps saying we're looking for when that is the last thing we need, choking on our individuality. Looking for his mind. There is a need to situate ourselves in regard to our own evolving, Sobin writes, trying to explain his dedication to obscure texts and buried bones. The dead are not about death. I get that, now. But he is making the point not as a personal recognition of loss and its uses, but as history, on this stretch of land where the model of the human, lost and lost and lost yet again, layer upon lost layer, is found in the patient pursuit of vestiges over time. Reading books, visiting museums, or simply stopping short before the vast gold umbrella of some chestnut tree in mid-autumn, he says, aren't we always, in a sense, looking for ourselves? And who would that be? Not the psychological self musing over its wounds, mother, father, faithless friends, lovers, the whatever of personal history. You weren't for any of that either. Free your mind, you'd say. Let go of all that stuff. We loved Sobin. Oh, right. You weren't part of that. I found him on my own. After. Sobin's essays display a contemporary Montaigne mind pondering, interpreting. The job of being human is not figuring things out, but getting lost in thought. Isn't that what holding a vestige to the light is? Holding a vignette in mind? Shards. Bits. Considering them lost in thought. A wonderful figure of speech, you said one day when the phrase came up, wry and amused as you often were by a turn of phrase. The first gift you gave me, a dictionary, followed soon after by a thesaurus. Isn't thought supposed to find something, find an answer? But lost in thought is where we often were, where we wanted to be, you and I. Across the yellow kitchen table, another cup of coffee. Annette and I motored on to Bordeaux, stood before the giant statues of Montaigne and Montesquieu, facing off in the yawning Place de Quinconce like two figures made of salt. Somehow a city, even Montaigne's city, he had been the mayor of Bordeaux, was not for us. Back to the Route de Foie Gras, into the tourist town of Sarlat, birthplace of Montaigne's beloved friend, Étienne de la Boétie, whose house, wedged into a turn, facing the main square and rising to a peaked roof, is marked with a historic plaque, The whole area chock-a-block with shops selling, what else, jars of foie gras. Had his beloved friend lived? No essays. Or so Montaigne felt. Death and loss threw him into the